CBS, Eye on the World, I'm John Batchelor. Eugene Debs, candidate for the presidency in 1920. Eugene Debs, a man identified with the Wobblies, the international workers of the world, a man identified with socialism in America. In 1918, Eugene Debs, extremely well known in the newspapers, much attendance at his speeches. He had a golden tongue. This was the age of William Jennings Bryan. The men could speak without microphone, without amplification. They were magical. Well, in 1918, the U.S. is at war, and Eugene Debs makes a speech recommending in Canton, Ohio, that his audience resist the draft. That is right, resist the draft. He says the war is a product of capitalism distortion, and that do not in any fashion regard this as patriotism to fight for the capitalists. He is arrested later that month. He's tried by the Wilson administration using the law called the Espionage Act. He's convicted after a golden speech for 2 hours in the courtroom and sentenced to 10 years in jail. That does not stop Eugene Debs from speaking out. And in 1920, he's a candidate for the presidency, as he had been in 1912. I mention all this because I welcome Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, who in recent conversations with his colleagues reminds all of us that in the event that the former president, Mr. Trump, is arrested and convicted and jailed, there is precedent to run for the presidency from a jail cell. And Eugene Debs in 1912 won 6% of the vote. And this is before women widely voted. In 1920, he won less than that, but certainly enough votes, 919,000, to impress anybody at that moment that there was great sympathy for Eugene Debs, as we can imagine there would be for any former president who was jailed while he was running for re-election. Richard, a very good evening to you. Thank you for reminding all of us about Eugene Debs. Now that we've established the precedent, we go to what the Wall Street Journal quite correctly characterizes as the tawdry facts of the expectation that a grand jury will return an indictment and that Donald Trump will be arrested for a twisted pattern of violations that I can't summarize. Good evening to you, Richard.
Well, welcome to the crowd. I think the prediction that was made 3 days ago that the Bragg situation would result in a prosecution is actually much less clear today than it was then. If you recall, this was supposed to be done on a Tuesday, maybe a Wednesday, certainly a Thursday, absolutely, definitely. Friday, the grand jury doesn't meet, so it has to be put over to next week. There are all sorts of rumors that there's bitter divisions inside the Bragg Police Department, Attorney General's office. Some people saying yes, some people saying no. And there is the general sense that, well, is this grand jury really going to convict? The old view used to be that if the attorney in charge of the case, Mr. Bragg, wanted that, he could get an indictment from a passive grand jury of a ham sandwich but being eaten. But we don't know whether this is going to go. I have read commentaries like everybody else from both left and right. I have yet to find anybody who thinks that this is a strong case. This is a case in which he pretends to be a bound slave. He is being driven by the sheer force of his case to bring this prosecution and has no discretion to avoid it, is the way he puts it. He has an enormous discretion to avoid it, given the shaky nature of the case and the compound complications arising out of trying to marry a federal voting fraud campaign contribution case to a simple state case having to do with the falsification of records. To make things worse, I just heard, I can't verify this, that it turns out that Bragg's office did not meet its Brady obligations. In plain English, what this means is nobody gets to take discovery of the prosecutor's office to find out what they have, but the prosecutor is on his own motion required to turn over to the party who's charged any and all exculpatory evidence that the prosecution office has in its files. And evidently, it may well be that they did not do this with some of the materials. So wholly before we get to the substantive issues, we get a really complicated statute of limitations problem, and now maybe a Brady rule problem. There may be some other jurisdictional issues that I'm unaware about this case. But nobody seems to think that it's worth the candle, except our crusader Bragg, and his credibility is damaged. I think it's fair to say, by the fact that when he was running for office, he said, I'm happy to indict Mr. Trump 1,000 times. That hardly sounds like somebody who's a neutral expert trying to figure out how the scales of justice require him to teach Donald Trump. And as you mentioned, nobody, I think, wants to defend Donald Trump as a business or a moral or as an ethical matter. I made it very clear that I think it's a total disaster if he should run for president again. I would do everything to stop it, but one has to be very clear that you don't bring the criminal system to bear because you have deep political objections against somebody running for president. And that's the principle that's likely to be lost here, and it may be lost in Washington, D.C., and it may be lost in Georgia.
The story, however, is not limited to Manhattan. I learned from reading and from your conversations. There is also a case in Georgia about intimidation and bad acting at the vote. There is also a case about the classified documents at Mar-a-Lago and whether Mr. Trump was candid in responding to investigators. And then there is the pending matter of culpability for January 6th. So those four issues all can be presented as the rule of law, and no one is above the law. The question that I'm most keen on, Richard, is Eugene Debs's precedent, running from a jail cell. This means that politics becomes prosecute the loser. And that has happened in other countries, and it has happened in our country, I believe, at the point of conflict, that we have often had political events that turn into court cases when someone has the power to do it.
I think it's a terribly dangerous precedent.
Yes, you do. And I wanted you to expand on that, because it's not just what if you turn around and do it to the other side. It's the credibility to the voting public. The public will be alienated permanently, and democracy cannot do with a minority with a turnout of less than 50%. It struggles to maintain credibility.
Well, I think what happens is the first thing people say, if I can do it to you, then you can do it to me. And well, right now we have two examinations at the federal level. The one of Trump seems to be moving ahead at warp speed on Mar-a-Lago. I regard that as potential obstruction. I don't wish to deny the silliness or the seriousness of the event, but it certainly doesn't justify, in my mind, sort of throwing the entire presidential election into chaos. But on the other hand, there are potential investigations ordered by Merrick Garland of Hunter Biden and his various activities, many of which involve receiving money from foreign parties that are undisclosed, some of which are claimed to be shuttled back to Biden when he was between terms. Now, all of this stuff going on there. And what you'll do is you'll have a special prosecutor who will take till 2025 to give some kind of report. And so to make things even worse, you have to understand that at least when it comes to the federal case, it's the Attorney General or the President of the United States who appoints the special prosecutor. And in these particular situations, whom you appoint tells a huge deal about the way in which you want these things to go. You take somebody who's slow and cautious, it's like burying it. You take somebody who's very aggressive, you have very little power to control them once the appointments are made, and they can bring in the indictment. And so the case that I probably fear the most under these circumstances is, in fact, the Mar-a-Lago case, because I think what it does is it implicates the federal government, which means that tit-for-tat and political intrigue are going to become even more intense than they were to this date. The Georgia thing, I mean, it's, again, a very difficult situation. I have seen the pictures, as of everybody else, of the fact that this Georgia office in Atlanta gets shut down mysteriously in the middle of the night. Everybody is basically evacuated from the room because of this assertive lead. Then there are some boxes that are wheeled out, and the questions, do they contain fake ballots or true ballots? I can't answer any of these questions. I keep reminding people, I'm a professor of law, not a professor of facts with sort of detailed knowledge. But at least for somebody who's on the losing end of this in a close vote, they can say, I think what's going on here is terrible. So now what you do is, against this background, you listen to a hysterical pump talking to the Secretary of State Raffelsberger on this particular matter. He says, I want you to find the votes. What he's really saying is, I think this election was crooked because there were a lot of ballots that were cast that should not have been cast, and that I've been done in by this, and he wants this. It is clear that the Secretary of State does not wish to be caught up in a scandal of this particular sort. And so he attends and defends the probity of the situation, notwithstanding the fact that he's a Republican. And one would like to see an independent investigation of these cases, but that's just not going to happen because, again, in the hyperpartisan world that we have today, notwithstanding the real structural weaknesses in the way the ballots were collected in a COVID age, everybody has pronounced these elections as safe and sound. So that's the situation. And if that's the predicate, then what he is trying to do is to take a sound election and turn it into a corrupt election. He is no longer a president who's protesting a corrupt election and trying to turn it into a sound one. And I think that there's some possibility that there'll be a prosecution there. But I think it's a little bit less dangerous because it's done, A, by a Republican, and B, I think there's going to be a better chance for Trump to defend himself. I think the special prosecutor at the federal level is a terrible mistake. And I think what's happening is, you are right to say, tit-for-tat retaliation will become the norms. It's like a South American dictatorship. And that what happens is the public that's standing by loses its confidence in both parties. And it turns out, the more I get older on these things, the more it becomes clear to me that the success of a democratic nation depends upon its culture and its ethos and its public commitment and its legitimacy, less than upon any particular legal order that some court can issue at one time or another. And if you destroy the trust that exists in this country and our political institutions, which is happening at a very rapid rate today, there'll be huge dislocations and hell to pay tomorrow.
A detail: in Brazil, just these conditions have pertained. Lula da Silva, now president of Brazil, was convicted and jailed for corruption. He was released, not forgiven. He was released on the basis of technicality about jurisdiction. He then successfully ran for president again, dividing the nation bitterly in half. And now there is talk of asking for an extradition of the previous president, Mr. Bolsonaro, from the United States to Brazil to stand for charges about misbehavior during the election and afterwards. In other words, Brazil has become what you'd have to say an arena of just the kind of bitterness that we can project in the United States should Mr. Trump either be jailed or prosecuted during the campaign. Richard, you talk of prosecutorial discretion. What's happened to it?
Well, nothing has happened to it. It means that you could prosecute when you have a weak case or not prosecute when you have a strong case. We hope that that will not happen very, very often. But Bragg certainly is under no duty to prosecute a case this week. Everybody understands that. When he starts talking about maintaining the rule of law, he forgets that our system of the rule of law has always built prosecutorial discretion into it, because there is no simple formula which tells you whether his case is important enough or strong enough to be subject to being brought. Everybody that I know who's looked at this case has counseled against it, at least people from the outside. I don't know of anybody who thinks that it's a strong case. And that means when you're dealing with a political figure, prosecutorial discretion says you don't bring the kind of case which is likely to set the entire political structure of the United States into a certain kind of bad cycle, downward movement that could contaminate the next election, which is likely to be bitter, even if nothing is done. But Mr. Bragg seems to be oblivious about all of this stuff. He's generated huge amounts of controversy within his office. He's the kind of district attorney who may well be subject to a recall motion. This is all very, very bad stuff. And I would hope that he would just drop this kind of case, would beg him to drop this sort of case, because what happens is people are much more concerned with crime on the street, and he's notoriously bad at dealing with those sorts of issues. So I do think, in effect, there's a crisis there. I think the situation in the White House or in the Attorney General's office, I've been very disappointed in the performance of Merrick Garland. I think he's been a weak and ineffective figure. And I think that there's two choices for the special prosecutor in the Biden matter and in the Trump matter have been a very, very bad sign. I have no confidence in anything that he has done thus far. And I think he should back off of this, but it's not clear that he can. And the Georgia thing, again, I don't believe that what Trump said is sufficient to make it that he's saying, please suborn the election. I think what he was saying is, you guys basically let this thing be corrupt, and I want you to correct the corruption. And if you read today, there is nobody but nobody in the public press who is prepared to attack the the soundness of any of the elections that took place in 2020. And so long as that's going to be the mindset, Trump is going to be in great trouble. But I think if you're worried about serious First Amendment values, we don't want to have such a strong consensus that anybody who challenges the probity of any of these elections on whatever ground is going to be treated as an outright
mistake. Let's leave the Constitution for another day and turn to something parochial, which is the rent control laws in New York City. We're going to stay in Manhattan, but this has to do with a proposal by the New York State legislature to change the rules again for landlords in these troubled times. Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.